From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our weekly update on news and events from the Latin America Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. And Tony, I know the local wildlife there tends to get a little noisy, the parrots that are in the wild out where you are. And we're going to have to, just plod along and hope they cooperate some. Jump in.
Yeah, there's always so much to discuss when one looks at a week of reporting on Latin America, Central America, the Caribbean. And a big event over the last few days for us here in Nicaragua was the celebration of the 196th anniversary of Central American independence, which is a very big deal for the countries here in Central America. But and quite ironic, when given the reality currently, where in the United States still keeps especially Honduras and Guatemala, and to a lesser extent perhaps Costa Rica, very much under its thumb. And you can see that, and when you look at the events that have been happening over the last week in Guatemala, it's absolutely clear that what's going on there is a maneuver controlled from the United States, and perhaps to a lesser extent from the European Union, but certainly from the United States, to maintain its control in the country, in Guatemala, which is a very important country for different reasons, in particular from the point of view of migration to the United States and the so-called drugs war. And Guatemala, in effect, the United States is trying to turn Guatemala into an extension of Mexico, a kind of essentially a failed state that is completely beholden to corporate interests in the United States, whether you're talking about Monsanto on the agricultural front or arms companies on the security military front. Or Wall Street in terms of control of natural resources.
Yeah, all of that. And there's an irony here, too, just to interrupt for a second, that the independence from Spain in 1821 actually came through the hands of a plan drafted by someone from Mexico.
Yeah, it would be there. That itself is a very complicated history, but... Yeah, and obviously a very close relationship between Central America and Mexico, and that's all that history stuff. I'd have to bone up in my history books to get the detail right.
Yeah, that's okay. I just wanted to point that out because there is that irony, and it kind of smacked me in the face saying that.
It is a historic irony there. Yep. And so, what's going on in Guatemala right now? In Guatemala, we have, as you and I mentioned in our previous conversation, I think, this rerun of the situation in Guatemala that saw the deposing of Otto Perez just shortly before the presidential elections in Guatemala. When was that? 2 years ago?
Yeah, I think so.
Otto Perez is now in jail on corruption charges with various of his ministers. And now we're having this rerun with the administration of Jimmy Morales. But without going too much into the detail, there are some parallels. But Morales has managed to mobilize enough support in the legislature to prevent that body stripping him of his immunity, of his presidential immunity. And so the anti-corruption, the UN anti-corruption and impunity body called CICIG in its Spanish acronym, that's run by a guy, I think his name is Velasquez, and he's very much a pawn of the United States and the so-called international community in its United Nations manifestation. But the interesting thing about that, the whole situation, is that it reflects a much broader continent-wide phenomenon which is the way that this judicialization of political life in Guatemala is essentially stripping Guatemala of its national sovereignty.
Yeah, like Brazil, like Argentina, they tried that with the direction against the Cristina. That's a they grab whatever levers they can. These characters and the judiciary, you have usually long terms, and so even in places where you have leftist or at least a democratic government, there are legacy judges that can be found from the old military dictatorships all over the place.
Yeah, and it depoliticizes public life, because
facially,
it means
right.
that unelected officials, these judges,
right.
Plus their managerial support network in the non-governmental network in a given country, they are the ones that call the shot.
Yeah,
plus they decide who's disqualified from public life and who isn't.
That's right. And they also, you have the pretense of it being non-ideological again. In places where the failed ideology of the right is rejected by the population, well, we can still get rid of the champions of the left by calling them crooks, basically. Hey, look, it's not because he's a leftist, has nothing to do with ideology. He's a crook, and so he's got to go. Or in the case, for example, of Brazil, she had to go.
Right. And although in Guatemala, Jimmy Morales is a center-right figure backed by elites
right.
in the military, the model is essentially the United States is experimenting in Guatemala as a kind of laboratory to see how far it can go with this judicialization of public life
right.
And a nation's political life. And so... And then when you look at Argentina, of course, in Argentina, the main, and I think we talked about this also in the past, the main public figure there representing progressive politics is Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner.
Right.
And she is stands a very good chance of winning a position in the Senate in the upcoming legislative elections that are on the 22nd of October. But... What's very interesting in Argentina is the way this recent case of the disappearance of an activist defending indigenous people's rights, Mapuche people's rights in Argentina, a guy called Santiago Maldonado. He was disappeared around 31st of July, 1st of August in very confused events that the government in Argentina, the right-wing government of Mauricio Macri, has deliberately worked to obscure and cover up. And even now, where are we? 6 weeks? 7 weeks? Getting on for 7 weeks after the events, there's still no clear line of investigation that accepts government responsibility for the disappearance of Santiago Maldonado. And but stepping back and looking at it from a continent-wide context, and it's very clear that this is going to be extremely embarrassing for the Argentinian government. And you just have to think back, in 30 years, and there were 30,000 people disappeared in Argentina and another similarly large number, perhaps not running into the tens of thousands in Chile, and similar repression in Uruguay. And so, and what it seems to me that this case of this very disturbing case of Santiago Maldonado in Argentina indicates the extent to which in a relatively advanced country in South America like Argentina, the repressive model, the model of military, police, state repression, it's still there, but they can only use it in a very limited way now because... Mm-hmm. And largely because of the huge advances over the last 10, 15 years
right.
by popular movements in all those countries.
Yep.
And the slogan in Argentina is never again.
Right.
And never again will they go back to the days of the military dictatorship.
Yep.
And so when you look at what events in Argentina and Brazil and the judicialization of political life in Argentina with the attacks on Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, whereas very clear corruption on the part of Mauricio Macri and his family and his colleagues gets treated very softly, very gently. They're still going after Cristina Fernandez on the basis of completely bogus charges.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter, there's a sense in which it doesn't matter. And we can see this in the case of Lula da Silva in Brazil, can't we? And there's no solid evidence against him, but the cases proceed. They have their own legal Kafkaesque logic and momentum. So once somebody gets accused of something,
right,
the process can go on for years and years and years,
right,
effectively hobbling their ability to participate actively in the country's political life.
Yeah, so not only that, sorry to interrupt on that, but, you know, not for nothing, there weren't even allegations of wrongdoing, you know, of criminal activity against, former president. Rather, the controversy was civil in nature and not criminal, that she, you know, put this in this column instead of that column, basically, when they were doing the budget. And yet, she was removed for that. And the other thing, just while you're on it, you have a judge in the Maldonado case who's running interference for them, saying, he probably drowned. He wasn't, there's no evidence he was disappeared.
Absolutely outrageous. And the response by the judicial and political authorities in Argentina,
yep,
has been absolutely outrageous. And I think that it's going to go very much against them in the legislative election,
yep,
but we'll see. Now, I don't want to get too bogged down in that.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
So, it's important that people, when they're looking at events in Latin America and the Caribbean, it's important not to get too bogged down in the detail, because so much, almost everything that happens, reflects much deeper things going
right,
on.
Right, that's right.
Like, now, and if you look at what's happening in Peru, for example, and also, this is the stuff in Guatemala and the stuff in Argentina, and it has echoes in Peru. And what's happening in Peru over the last 2 or 3 weeks, has been a demonstration of the power of the right-wing bloc led by Keiko Fujimori, the daughter of the former dictator Alberto Fujimori, who's still in jail,
right,
in Peru,
right,
for crimes under his dictatorship. Now, what happened in Peru, and last year, a guy called Kuczynski, a right-wing bureaucrat, technocrat kind of guy, defeated Keiko Fujimori very narrowly in the presidential elections, and which just goes to show how right-wing political opinion generally in Peru is. And although the Frente Amplio, a kind of leftist progressive bloc, did quite well, they didn't come anywhere close to getting into the second round presidential runoff, which was between essentially two right-wing figures. Now what's happened is that Keiko Fujimori and her political bloc, who, although they very narrowly lost the presidential elections, they did very well in the legislative elections.
Yeah.
And they have something like 70, 71 seats in a 130-seat legislature. So they have a very clear majority to block whatever Kuczynski might want to do by way of a legislative program.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done just that. And what they go through periodic phases of crisis in which Kuczynski's prime minister, his recent prime minister, put a vote. He asked for a confidence vote in the legislature on their legislation, and they lost it. And that means that, and as a result of Keiko Fujimori and her people's control in the legislature, so that means that Kuczynski has to present a new cabinet that has to be approved by the legislature. If that's not approved, then there's a new election. And that's happening in a context in which, and for the last, and I think the teacher strike, national teacher strike, is still going on. And that's, you know, and that, so that, that whole process reflects a kind of institutional crisis that takes different forms in different countries. But and this is the form it's taking in Peru. But that the what I find interesting about these events in Peru, Brazil, Bolivia, is that they're taking place against a background of deep economic change, whereby and this This deep economic change threatens very much United States control of Latin America, and that's why the United States is engaging in these new modalities of getting control of public life and political life in Latin America.
Right.
Because they see national politicians, even centrist or even right-wing politicians, looking more and more towards China. And that was reflected in a meeting in La Paz in Bolivia last week between representatives of six Latin American countries and I think a total of four European countries, not at not necessarily at a governmental level, some at a governmental level and some at a very high corporate level, looking at the interoceanic railway. You had Paraguay, Brazil, Bolivia, Argentina, and what was the other country? Uruguay, I think, taking part in this meeting with Bolivia, looking at how to move that interoceanic rail project forward. And it's a rail project that will run from the port of Santos, just outside Sao Paulo on Brazilian's southeastern coast, Atlantic coast, all the way through to a port called Ilo on Peru's Pacific coast. Now, that's important because Ilo is the port that Bolivia and Peru are negotiating a much broader trade and customs set of protocols to help Bolivia break the effective blockade that they suffered from Chile for the last 100 or so years, getting on for 150 years now, resulting from that war back in 1879 when Chile stripped Bolivia of its access to the sea. So this whole project is really important from all kinds of points of view.
Right.
And what is likely to happen in Peru is that Fujimori's bloc, which probably is that both she and Kuczynski are regarded as allies by the United States, but the United States is probably pushing to work more closely with Fujimori's bloc, the most extreme right-wing bloc, just as they are in Brazil and Argentina, because they see that as giving them more leverage in terms of controlling events like this interoceanic railway.
Yeah.
Now, so then there's that going on, and then of course this stuff it's really complicated stuff on some levels.
You know, well, and part of the reason for that, just you know, if you think about what's going on here, looking at a map of South America, if you sketch from point A to point B, the development of this rail line across the continent. It's a transcontinental railway.
Yes.
You know, go back 200 years or 150 years or whatever it was when they built one in the United States, and it opened up the whole heart of the nation and the continent, really, to development that, you know, was perhaps unprecedented in history. And now, finally, this is coming to South America. And if you look at the path, you know, you're not just going for the shortest route, which might be, you know, all the way down at the southern tip or in Central America, but rather through the heart of South America, which means the whole path of that is going to be a corridor for development of the entire continent.
And regional integration.
Yeah, right. And so China is offering this opportunity to South America. What the United States offers is, we want to make your guys work a little harder and pull some more nickel out of the mines, and maybe we'll throw you an extra Big Mac at the end of the year and some lawyers and accountants. That's, you know, it's not hard to compete with the United States on the ground when all it's offering is more intensive exploitation.
Right, and the other very important thing, I mean, it's important to look at what else is happening In this context. I mean, look at what Venezuela's just done. They've said that they're no longer going to sell their oil in dollars.
Yeah.
They're going to sell it in Chinese yuan.
Yep.
And so, and if you look at that kind of, and the United States, and at this stage, it's far, you know, it sounds really stupid, but it's far from clear that the United States is going to get its way in Venezuela.
That's right.
Now, if you'd said that 20 years ago, people would have laughed at you.
That's right.
But it's very much the case now that Venezuela may stand a very good chance of being able to pull off this what many people regard as a gamble of refusing to sell their oil in dollars and shifting to a basket of currencies led by the yuan. You know, but they stand a very good chance of pulling it off.
Yep.
And one of the reasons that they've been very, very careful and astute and subtle, if you like, in the way they've handled the endless assault to which the Nicolas Maduro government has been subject since the death of Hugo Chavez back in 2013. And they managed to defeat the attempt by the Venezuela's political opposition to overthrow the legitimately elected government via violent means out in the street. And political opposition is now forced to negotiate with the government in the run-up to the regional elections that will be held on October the 15th.
Yep.
And that's a massive political defeat for the United States, and it explains in large measure why President Trump and his administration are intensifying the sanctions against Venezuela, because essentially they've lost, and their attempt to overthrow Nicolas Maduro has failed despite everything that they've done, and it looks as though Nicolas Maduro and the United Venezuelan Socialist Party will do very well in the regional elections. They may not make a clean sweep, but they're likely to get a very clear majority of the governorships that are going to be up for election on October the 15th. And at the moment, it's very clear that the Venezuelan opposition don't know what to do. They feel bound to take part in the regional elections, but they fear that they're not going to do very well, and rightly. And what that means is that come 2018, when the presidential elections happen, Nicolas Maduro may be very well placed if his various economic policies that he announced also last week, principally dealing with the exchange rate and the supply of basic goods nationally throughout Venezuela, if those policies work, and he's likely to get re-elected.
Yep.
So, you know, and
this is where China can play a very important role there. I mean, we have discussed, numerous times, and it's obvious, the central role of Venezuela in the, project towards integration and, self-determination, national sovereignty that's been ongoing in Latin America. Venezuela at the heart of that. The U.S. being very aware of that is basically the biggest foil to the Monroe Doctrine that's ever existed since the early 19th century. And so it's been a target. And you say 20 years ago, people would say, well, it's ridiculous to say that Venezuela can stand up to the United States' continued assault. But now one of the reasons that people will listen to that is because 20 years later, the U.S. has been, a constant assault, including a coup 15 years ago, and Venezuela still stands.
Yeah. Yeah, those events are very important and should be seen in this regional context of even right-wing governments shifting their economic and other relations towards China rather than towards the United States. And the United States' response to that is multifaceted and includes the kind of events that we're seeing in Guatemala and Brazil, and to a lesser extent perhaps in Argentina, using the judicial route to try and get control of national politics in those countries. So other stuff going on, and input, the peace process in Colombia has been very important, it's interesting it's difficult to link stuff in. I know why. And what's happening with the internal peace process in Colombia means that Colombia will be able to realize its full potential without being held back by what was a civil war lasting well over 50 years.
Right.
They're in peace. The government is in peace talks with the other main guerrilla group, the National Liberation Army, the ELN. And it's a very patchy process. And you and I have discussed in the past how the what happens with the paramilitaries in Colombia that were the power base for former President Álvaro Uribe is very important. There was a significant judgment last week in the Colombian courts whereby they found a total of 32 of the paramilitary leaders of the so-called Colombian self-defense, United Self-Defense Organization. 32 of those, of the leaders of that organization were found guilty of a total of over 4,000 murders between 1999 and 2006.
Wow.
Now, that is a massive political defeat for Álvaro Uribe, because Álvaro Uribe was one of the founders of that paramilitary organization.
Mm.
And for them, for 32 of his former relatively low-level commanders to be found guilty in the Colombian courts is a massive political defeat for him.
Yeah.
And it gives strength and some impetus to the government, if the government of Juan Manuel Santos really wants to implement the peace agreement that was reached in Havana last year. And then that should strengthen Juan Manuel Santos's hand if he's serious about cracking down on the paramilitaries.
Yeah, I mean, you would think that they would take advantage of the fact that if you got 30-some-odd underlings all facing who knows what, long prison terms and or, murder charges or convictions, of that stuff, one of them might flip. And then suddenly, the gendarme are outside Uribe's house dragging him off to the docks.
Yeah, and I don't think we're going to see that. Álvaro Uribe is a much too powerful figure.
Just saying, if he's serious, if Santos is serious about it.
Yeah, it's far too much dirt as well on Santos and his colleagues.
Yeah, right. I guess that too.
unlikely to, but it is a political setback for Álvaro Uribe. And, I don't have much optimism in terms of the seriousness or the goodwill of Santos in terms of implementing the agreement.
Right.
As from Santos's point of view, they got the agreement. The FARC have complied with everything, and the government can just take their time and use the demoralization that they will impose by dragging their feet on the implementation of the agreement. They're going to impose demoralization within the ranks of the FARC, and that will weaken the political momentum that the FARC might otherwise have been able to generate.
Well, you sound like, when you talk that way, it sounds like you've seen this before.
Here in Nicaragua back in 1990, it took 17 years for the FSLN to recover sufficient political support and maneuver with sufficient, and so as to get sufficient political capital to get back into office, if not power.
Right.
And they won, Daniel Ortega and the FSLN won the 2006 elections, and they got into office. But it took them another 5 years of very difficult political struggle and efforts to implement their political program before they got a clear, outright democratic mandate for their program. And what's likely to happen, and who knows? And I'm not an expert on Colombia by any means, but it seems to me that in what the Colombian government is doing, they're very well known for their this style of agreeing but not implementing the agreement.
Yeah, well, again, as I said, they've got a history of that. So we're going to have to pick it up here next week, Tony, and I really appreciate your time. I wish we had 3 or 4 hours, a week to discuss this stuff because there's so much to cover, but thank you very much.
Thank you, Don. Look forward to talking to you next week.
You got it, thanks. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.